When Reynolds was gone, Kyle went online to a website called QuickFace.com. There were several sites that allowed amateur sleuths to put together composite sketches of faces, and Kyle had studied them all. QuickFace was by far the most detailed and accurate. He began with Nigel's eyes, always the most important feature. Get the eyes right, and half the identification is over. The site offered over 200 different types of eyes, every race, color, origin, and blend. Kyle went through them quickly, found the closest set, and began his face. Nose, thin and pointed. Eyebrows, moderately thick and a bit long down the sides. Lips, very thin. Cheekbones, higher and wider. Chin, not long but very flat, no dimple. Ears, oval and stuck close to the skull. After he added the hair, he went back to the eyes, tried another pair, then another. The ears were too high, so he lowered them. He tinkered and sculpted until 6:30, a half hour unbilled and wasted unless he chose to pad a bit during the day. And when Nigel was properly put together and easily identified from 40 feet away, Kyle printed the face and hustled off to the library, carrying a thick file because everyone carried a thick file into the library. His private spot was a dead end in a dark corner on the third level of stacked tiers, a lonesome place where they stored thick tomes of annotations no one had used in decades. On the second shelf from the bottom, he lifted three of the books and removed an unmarked manila envelope, letter-sized. He opened it and pulled out three other composites, a splendid rendering of his archenemy Benny and two others of the goons who were stalking him around New York City. To his knowledge, he had not been within 50 feet of them and had never made eye contact, but he'd seen both on several occasions and was confident that his artwork was at least a decent starting point. The addition of Nigel's dreadful face to the collection did nothing to improve its overall attractiveness. He hid the envelope and returned to the cube, where Tabor the Gunner was busy making his usual noisy preparations for the day. The issue of whose career held the most promise had been settled weeks earlier. Tabor was the man, the star, the fast-tracked partner-to-be, and everyone else could get out of the way. He'd proven his talents by billing 21 hours in a single day. He'd shown his skill by billing more the first month than all other litigation rookies, though Kyle was only 4 hours behind. He volunteered for projects and worked the cafeteria like an old Irish ward boss. "Slept in the library last night," he said as soon as he saw Kyle. "Good morning, Tabor." "The carpet in the main library is thinner than the carpet in the 23rd library. Did you know that, Kyle? I much prefer sleeping on the 23rd, but it does have more noise. Which do you prefer?"
"We're all cracking up, Tabor."
"Yes, we are. Tim used his sleeping bag last night." "For what? He and Dr. Dale finally getting it on?"
"Don't know about that. I woke him up an hour ago."
"So you went home? Slept in your own bed?"
"Oh, yes."
"Well, I have two projects due at noon today, both extremely important and urgent, and I can't afford the luxury of sleep."
"You're the greatest, Tabor. Go, Superman."
And with that, Tabor was gone.
Dale Armstrong arrived promptly at 7, her usual time, and though she looked a bit sleepy, she was put together as always. Evidently, the bulk of her fat salary was being spent on designer clothing, and Kyle, along with Tim and Tabor, looked forward to the daily fashion statement.
"You look great today," Kyle said with a smile.
"Thank you."
"Prada?"
"Dolce & Gabbana."
"Killer shoes. Blahniks?"
"Jimmy Choo."
$500?
"Don't ask." Admiring her each day, Kyle was quickly learning the names of the high priests of female clothing. It was one of the few topics she cared to discuss. After 6 weeks of shared space in the cube, he still knew very little about her. When she talked, which was not very often, it was always about law firm business and the miserable life of a first-year associate. If there was a boyfriend, he had yet to be mentioned. She had dropped her guard twice and agreed to drinks after work, but she usually declined. And while every rookie was openly grousing about the hours and the pressure, Dale Armstrong seemed to be feeling the strain more than most.
"What are you doing for lunch?" Kyle asked.
"I haven't had breakfast yet,"
she replied coolly,
and withdrew into her little section of the cube. Chapter 22. The lights in the shelter came on each morning at 6, and most of the homeless awoke and began making preparations for another day. The rules did not allow them to stay past 8 o'clock. Many had jobs, but those who didn't were expected to be on the streets looking for employment. Brother Manny and his staff were very successful in placing their friends, even if the work was often part-time and minimum wage. Breakfast was served upstairs in the fellowship hall, where volunteers manned the small kitchen and prepared eggs, toast, oatmeal, and cereal. And it was served with a smile, a warm good morning for everyone, and a quick prayer of thanks once they were all seated. Brother Manny, a notorious late sleeper, preferred to delegate the early morning duties at his compound. For the past month, the kitchen had been organized and supervised by Baxter Tate, a smiling young man who'd never boiled water in his previous life. Baxter scrambled eggs by the dozen, toasted loaves of white bread, prepared the oatmeal, real, not instant, and also restocked the supplies, washed the dishes, and he, Baxter Tate, often said the prayer. He encouraged the other volunteers, had a kind word for everyone, and knew the names of most of the homeless he graciously served. After they had eaten, he loaded them into 3 old church vans, drove one himself, and delivered them to their various jobs around Reno. He picked them up late in the afternoon. Alcoholics Anonymous met 3 times each week at Hope Village, Monday and Thursday nights and at noon on Wednesday. Baxter never missed a meeting. He was warmly received by his fellow addicts and quietly marveled at the group's compositions, all races, ages, male and female, professionals and homeless, rich and poor. Alcoholism cut a wide, jagged path through every class, every segment. There were old, confident drunks who boasted of being sober for decades, and new ones like himself who freely admitted that they were still afraid. They were comforted, though, by the veterans. Baxter had made a mess of his life, but his history was a cakewalk compared to that of some of the others. Their stories were compelling, often shocking, especially those of the ex-convicts. During his 3rd AA meeting, with Brother Manny watching from the rear, he walked to the front of the group, cleared his throat, and said, "My name is Baxter Tate, and I'm an alcoholic from Pittsburgh." After he uttered those words, he wiped tears from his cheeks and listened to the applause. Following the 12 steps to recovery, he made a list of all the people he had harmed and then made plans to make amends. It wasn't a long list and was heavily focused on his family. He did not, however, look forward to a return to Pittsburgh. He'd talked to Uncle Wally. The family knew he was still sober, and that was all that mattered. After a month, he began to grow restless. He did not relish the thought of leaving the safety of Hope Village, but he knew the time was coming. Brother Manny encouraged him to make his plans. He was too young and smart and gifted to spend his life in a homeless shelter. "God has big plans for you," Brother Manny said. "Just trust him, and they will be revealed." When it looked as if they might escape at a decent hour on Friday night, Tim Reynolds and others quickly organized a drinking party and hurried out of the building. Saturday was to be a rare day off. No member of the litigation group at Scully and Pershing could be seen at work on Saturday because it was the annual family picnic in Central Park. Thus, Friday night was cleared for serious drinking. Kyle declined, as did Dale. Around 7 p.m., as they were both wrapping up the last details of an endless week, and with no one else around, she leaned around the canvas partition that separated their tight cubicles and said, "What about dinner?"
"Great idea," Kyle said without hesitation. "Any place in particular?"
"My place. We can relax and talk and do whatever. You like Chinese?"
"Love it."
The word "whatever" was bouncing around his addled brain. Dale was 30, single, attractive, apparently straight, a pretty lady alone in the big city. At some point, she had to think about sex, though Kyle was depressed at how little he thought about it. Was she picking him up? It was a startling idea. Dale was so shy and reserved, it was hard to believe she would put the move on anyone.
Why don't you pick up some Chinese and bring it over? She said. Great idea.
She lived alone in Greenwich Village, in a fourth-floor walk-up. They discussed various takeout restaurants in the neighborhood, then left the office together. An hour later, Kyle climbed the stairs with a sack of shrimp and chicken fried rice and knocked on the door. Dale opened it with a smile and welcomed him to her apartment. Two rooms, a den-kitchen combo, and one bedroom. It was small but nicely decorated, a minimalist theme with leather and chrome and black and white photos on the wall. She too was well-appointed and pursuing the less-is-more approach. Her white cotton skirt was extremely short and revealed more of the slender legs Kyle and the other vultures had been admiring. Her shoes were short heels, open toe, no straps, red leather, high-class tart stuff. Kyle glanced at them and said, "Jimmy Choo's?"
"Prada."
The black cotton sweater was tight, without a bra under it. For the first time in far too many weeks, Kyle began to feel the excitement of sexual arousal. "Nice place," he said, looking at a photograph.
$4,000 a month. Can you believe it?"
She was opening the fridge, one about the size of a large desktop computer. She removed a bottle of white wine. "Yes, I can believe it. It's New York, but no one made us come here." She was holding the bottle of Chardonnay.
"I'm sorry, but I don't have any club soda. It's either wine or water."
"I'll have some wine," he said, with only a slight hesitation. And he decided on the spot that he would not torment himself by arguing back and forth about whether he should take a drink after 5.5 years of sobriety. He'd never been to rehab, never been forced to detox, never considered himself an alcoholic. He had simply stopped drinking because he was drinking too much, and now he wanted a glass of wine. They ate on a small square table, their knees almost touching. Even at home and completely relaxed, conversation did not come easily for Dale, the mathematician. He could not imagine her in a classroom in front of 50 students, and he certainly couldn't picture her in a courtroom in front of a jury. "Let's agree that we will not talk about work," Kyle said, taking the lead. He took his fourth sip of wine.
"Agreed. But first, there's some great gossip."
"Let's have it."
"Have you heard about the split?"
"No."
"There's a rumor. I heard it twice today. That Toby Rowland and four other partners, all in litigation, are about to split and open their own firm. They may take as many as 20 associates."
"Why?"
"A fee dispute, the usual."
Law firms are famous for exploding, imploding, merging, and spinning off in all directions. The fact that some unhappy partners wanted their own show was no surprise, either at Scully or at any other firm. "Does that mean more work for the rest of us?" he asked.
"I sure hope so."
"Have you met Toby?"
"Yes, and I hope the rumor is true."
"Who's the biggest prick you've met so far?"
She took a sip of wine and thought about the question. "That's a tough one. So many contenders."
"Too many. Let's talk about something else."
Kyle managed to shift the conversation around to her. Background, education, childhood, family, college. She had never been married. One bad romance still stung. After one glass of wine, she poured another, and the alcohol loosened her up. He noticed that she ate almost nothing. He, though, devoured everything in sight. She pushed the topics back to his side of the table, and he talked about Duquesne and Yale. Occasionally, the law firm would get mentioned, and they would find themselves wrapped up in it.
When the wine and food were gone, she said,
"Let's watch a movie."
"Great idea," Kyle said. As she looked through her DVDs, he glanced at his watch.
10:20.
In the past 6 days, he'd pulled 2 all-nighters. He now owned a sleeping bag, and averaged 4 hours of sleep each night. He was physically and mentally exhausted, and the 2.5 glasses of quite delicious wine he'd just consumed were thoroughly soaking whatever brain he had left.
"Romance? Action? Comedy?"
she called out as she flipped through what appeared to be an extensive collection. She was on her knees, the skirt barely covering her rear. Kyle stretched out on the sofa because he didn't like the looks of either chair. "Anything but a chick flick."
"How about Beetlejuice?"
"Perfect." She inserted the disc, then kicked off her heels, grabbed a quilt, and joined Kyle on the sofa. She wedged and wiggled and snuggled and pulled the quilt over them. And when she was finally situated, there was a lot of contact. And then there was touching. Kyle sniffed her hair and thought how easy this was. "Doesn't the firm have a rule against this sort of thing?" he said. "We're just watching a movie." And they watched it. Warmed by the quilt, the wine, and each other's bodies, they watched the movie for all of 10 minutes. Later, they could not determine who fell asleep first. Dale woke up long after the movie was over. She spread the quilt over him, then went to bed. Kyle woke up at 9:30 on Saturday morning to an empty apartment. There was a note saying she was around the corner at a coffee shop reading the newspapers, so stop by if he was hungry. They rode the subway together to Central Park, arriving around noon. The litigation section of the firm threw a family picnic on the third Saturday of each October near the boathouse. The main event was a softball tournament, but there were also horseshoes, croquet, bocce, and games for the kids. A caterer barbecued ribs and chicken. A rap band made its noise. There was an entire row of iced kegs of Heineken. The picnic was to promote camaraderie and to prove that the firm did indeed believe in having fun. Attendance was mandatory. No phones allowed. For most associates, though, the time could have been better spent sleeping. At least they were not subject to being dragged into the office for another all-nighter. Only Christmas, New Year's, Thanksgiving, Rosh Hashanah, and Yom Kippur afforded the same protection. The day was clear, the weather perfect, and the weary lawyers shook off their fatigue and were soon playing hard and drinking even harder. Kyle and Dale, anxious to avoid even the possibility of gossip, soon separated and got lost in the crowd. Within minutes, Kyle heard the news that Jack McDougal, a second-year associate from Duke, had been arrested the night before when a narc team kicked in the door of his apartment in Soho and found a substantial stash of cocaine. He was still in jail and likely to remain there over the weekend until bail could be arranged on Monday. The firm was pulling strings to get him out, but the firm's involvement on his behalf would only go so far. Scully and Pershing took a hard line on such behavior. McDougal would be laid off, pending the charges. If the gossip turned out to be true, he would find himself unemployed in a few weeks. Kyle paused for a few minutes and thought about Benny. His chilling prediction had come true. Litigation had 28 partners and 130 associates. Two-thirds were married, and there was no shortage of young, well-dressed children running around. The softball tournament began with Mr. Wilson Rush, senior of all seniors, announcing the brackets and the rules and declaring himself the acting commissioner. Several lawyers had the guts to boo him, but then anything was permitted on this fine day. Kyle had elected to play, it was optional, and he found himself on a ragtag team with two people he'd met and seven he had not. Their coach was a partner named Cecil Abbott of Team Trilon, who was wearing a Yankees cap and a Derek Jeter jersey, and it was soon evident that Coach Abbott had never run to first base in his life. With a cold Heineken in hand, he prepared a lineup that couldn't beat a decent T-ball team. But then, who cared? Kyle, easily the best athlete, was stuck in right field. In center was Sherry Abney, the fifth-year associate Benny was stalking as Kyle's entree into the Trilon Barton case. As they came to bat in the first inning, Kyle introduced himself and chatted her up. She was visibly upset by the McDougal arrest. They had worked together for 2 years. No, she had no idea he had a drug problem. Mingling was encouraged, and after Coach Abbott's team was finally saved by the mercy rule in the fourth inning, Kyle plunged into the crowd and said hello to every strange face he encountered. Many of the names were familiar. He had, after all, been studying the bios for 6 weeks. A notorious partner, Birch Mason, also clad in Yankee garb and half-drunk by 2 p.m., grabbed Kyle like an old friend and introduced him to his wife and two teenage children. Doug Peckham took him around to meet some of the partners. The conversations were all the same. Where'd you go to school? How's it going so far? Bet you're worried about the bar exam results. Life gets better after the first year, and so on. And, can you believe McDougal? The tournament was double elimination, and Kyle's team distinguished itself by becoming the first to lose 2 games. He found Dale playing bocce, and they headed for the food tent. With plates of barbecue and bottles of water, they joined Tabor and his rather homely girlfriend at a table under a shade tree. Tabor, of course, was on a team that was undefeated, and he'd driven in the most runs so far. He had urgent work at the office and planned to be there at 6 the following morning.
"You win," Kyle wanted to say. "You win. Why don't they just go ahead and declare you a partner?"
Late in the afternoon, with the sun fading behind the towering apartment buildings on Central Park West, Kyle eased away from the party and found a park bench on a knoll under an oak. Golden leaves dropped around him. He watched the game in the distance, listened to the happy voices, smelled the last of the smoke from the grills. If he really tried, he could almost convince himself that he belonged at that party, that he was just another of the many successful lawyers taking a quick break from their hectic lives. But reality was never far away. If he got lucky, he would commit a heinous crime against the firm and not get caught. But if luck went against him, then one day during this family picnic, they would be talking about him the way they were talking now about McDougal. Chapter 23. Sunday, with most of the litigators nursing hangovers, Kyle was up early with a clear head, a tall coffee, walking shoes, and 5 hours to do nothing but hike the city. The firm phone was in his pocket, but the firm phone would not be ringing, because the Sunday after the picnic was a day off as well. A few of the gunners and diehards would be at the office, but most of the firm's litigators would savor another beautiful autumn day without billing an hour. He worked his way south, through the village and into Tribeca, then east into the frenzy of Chinatown. In Soho, he managed to get a seat at the bar at Balthazar, a popular restaurant modeled after a Parisian bistro and raved about in all the guides. He had eggs benedict and tomato juice, and was thoroughly entertained by the rowdy crowd. Then he found the Brooklyn Bridge, climbed to the top, to the promenade, and hiked across the East River to Brooklyn. It took 40 minutes, and then 40 minutes back into Manhattan, where he made his way to Broadway and followed it through the Garment District, the Theater District, Times Square, and on to Columbus Circle. Brunch was at 11:30 at the Upper West Side apartment of Doug and Shelley Peckham. It was an old building on 63rd, 2 blocks off Central Park, and as Kyle rode the stuffy elevator to the 3rd floor, he caught himself doing what most New Yorkers do in their spare time and even while they're working. He pondered real estate. Doug Peckham, as a 41-year-old full equity partner in the firm, earned $1.3 million the previous year. His income was no secret. Scully and Pershing, like most mega firms, published their numbers. Peckham could expect to earn at least that much for the rest of his career, so he could afford a nice place. But $1.3 million a year in New York was not exactly in the big leagues, not even close. The heavy hitters were the investment bankers, hedge fund whizzes, high-tech entrepreneurs, and corporate executives who were worth billions and thought nothing of dropping $20 million for a midtown apartment. And, of course, each had the obligatory weekend home in the Hamptons for the summer and one in Palm Beach for weekends in the winter. The Peckhams had a place in East Hampton. Kyle hoped Shelley and the kids enjoyed the summer house because he knew Doug certainly did not. He was at the office most Saturdays and often on Sundays. Shelley greeted him with a hug, another old friend now, and welcomed him into their open and unpretentious apartment. Doug was in jeans, sockless, unshaven, and pushing Bloody Marys on his guests. 4 other associates were present, all under the supervision of partner Peckham. The brunch was another effort by him and the firm to soften the edges and make Scully seem like a humane place after all. The goal of the get-together was to talk. Doug wanted to hear their problems and concerns, their ideas and plans, their impressions, and their goals. He also wanted to hurry up and finish brunch so they could watch the Giants versus the 49ers and drink beer, kick off at 1. Shelley did the cooking herself, and Doug helped serve and pour the wine. After an hour of useless chatter about the same boring lawsuits they'd slaved over all last week, it was time for the Giants. Kyle, the only first-year associate at the table, contributed less than anyone. Halfway through brunch, he was already planning his return hike downtown. After dessert, They gathered in the den, where a small fire made things cozy, and Doug fiddled with the controls to his high-def, flat-screen TV. In an effort to liven up a dying party, Kyle claimed to be an avid 49ers fan, a hater of the Giants, and this succeeded in generating some trash talk. Two of the older associates were asleep by the end of the first quarter. Doug began to nod off too, and at halftime, Kyle made a clumsy exit and hit the streets. At 5 on Monday morning, he was at the office, digging in for another long week. The Giants' next game was on the road, at Pittsburgh, and 2 hours before game time, Kyle and Joey Bernardo settled into their seats at the 40-yard line and tried to stay warm. A cold front had chased away autumn, and a freezing mist hovered above the new stadium. It didn't matter. As diehard Steelers fans, they had shivered through many games at Three Rivers Stadium, the old place that was gone now. They welcomed the cold. This was real football weather. Mercifully, Blair had little interest in football. Now 5 months pregnant, she had gained an enormous amount of weight and was not handling prospective motherhood too well. Joey was having second thoughts about marriage, but for some reason felt trapped. Kyle had little useful advice. If she wasn't pregnant, he would tell his friend to run. But you can't abandon a pregnant fiancé, can you? It just didn't seem right. What did he know about such matters? As the crowd settled in and the teams warmed up, Kyle was ready to talk. "Speak softly and tell me about Elaine Keenan," he said. Joey had a flask filled with vodka, his antifreeze. He took a swig, grimaced as if it tasted awful, and said, "Nothing but trouble." Their only correspondence about Elaine had been Joey's written summary of his encounter. Kyle needed all the details, and they needed a plan. "She is one bitter young woman," Joey said, "but she's not nearly as mean as her lawyer. Start at the beginning and tell me everything as it happened." Another swig, a good smacking of the lips, a glance around to make sure no one cared, and then Joey launched into a slow, thoughtful, detailed reenactment of his trip to Scranton. Kyle interrupted with questions, but the narrative moved along. Just before the coin toss, with the stadium packed and rocking, Joey finally finished with the admonition, "If they have the slightest opening, they'll attack us with a fury. Don't give them the opening. Let's just bury this little episode." They watched the game for a while and talked about nothing but football. During a timeout, Joey said, "So what's the plan? Can you come to New York next weekend? Steelers Jets, 4 o'clock Sunday at the Meadowlands. I'll get tickets." "Oh boy, I don't know." The problem was Blair, with money also a concern. Joey made a nice salary with commissions, but he wasn't getting rich. Now he had a baby on the way and a wife sometime after that, or vice versa, they couldn't decide. One day Blair wanted to postpone the wedding until the baby arrived so she could regain her figure. The next day she wanted to hurry up and get married so the birth wouldn't be out of wedlock. Joey was just straddling the fence, hanging on by his fingernails and getting whipsawed from both sides. They were now paying for an expensive new condo. He couldn't afford to spend too much watching football.
"Why do you want me in New York?" he asked.
"Because I want to try to get a photo of Benny."
"And why do you want a photo of this guy? These people are dangerous, right?"
"Oh yes, lethal."
"So why are we messing with them?"
"I want to know who they are." Joey shook his head and looked away toward the scoreboard. Then he took a sip and leaned close to Kyle.
"I say we leave them alone. I say you do what they want you to do. Play their games, don't get caught, keep the damned video buried, and life will be good for all of us."
"Maybe. Can you come to New York?"
"I don't know. I'll have to figure it out."
"It's very important. Please."
"How, old buddy, do you plan to get a picture of this guy Benny? He's a professional operative, right?"
"Something like that."
"You're a lawyer. I'm a stockbroker. We have no idea what we're doing, and we could easily get ourselves in trouble."
"Yes, we could."
Kyle took a small package from a pocket of his bulky black and gold Steelers parka.
"Take this," he said, keeping it low so that no one could see it.
Joey took it and stuffed it into a pocket of his own black and gold Steelers parka.
"What is it?"
"It's a video camera."
"Doesn't feel like a video camera."
"It's a video camera, but not one you're likely to see in a store window. The Steelers scored on a long pass, the game's first touchdown, and the crowd celebrated for 5 minutes. During the ensuing timeout, Kyle continued, "It's not much larger than an ink pen. It goes in the pocket of either a shirt or a jacket, with a thin wire running to a control switch in your left hand. You can talk to someone face to face and video the conversation without their knowledge."
"So I just walk up to Benny, who's probably heavily armed and has several other heavily armed pals nearby, and introduce myself and ask him to smile."
"No, there's a better way. But this week you need to practice with it."
"Does it have a name?"
"It's all there in the paperwork, specs, instructions, all that stuff. Just bone up on it this week and learn how to use it. If things go perfectly, you'll have about 3 seconds to video Benny."
"And if they don't go perfectly?"
"I'll rescue you."
"Great."
A long, nervous swig from the flask.
"So, Kyle, let's say we get Benny on video. How do you, not me, but you, go about identifying him?"
"I haven't figured that out."
"There's a lot you haven't figured out."
"I'll email you Tuesday, tell you I've got tickets, the usual drill. Are you in, Joey, old pal?"
"I don't know. I think you're crazy, and you're making me crazy."
"Come on. You need to have some fun while you can." Kyle was hard at work in the main library when the firm phone rattled softly at 4 on Thursday afternoon. The email described itself as urgent and commanded the first-year associates to congregate immediately on the 44th floor mezzanine, the largest gathering place at Scully and Pershing. The message meant only one thing: the bar exam results were in. And the fact that Kyle was being summoned meant that he had passed. For weeks, they had labored against the clock and suffered the often unbearable pressure of adjusting to life in the big firm, and added to that misery was the bar exam hanging over them like a dark cloud. It was always there, seldom discussed because the exam was over, and talking about it only made life worse. But it woke them up when they desperately needed sleep. It followed them to the table and could ruin a meal in an instant. The bar exam. What if they flunked the bar exam? The ritual varied from firm to firm, but Scully and Pershing had a rather pleasant way of breaking the news. They gathered the lucky ones together and threw a party. Though it was supposed to be a surprise, by the second week of September, every new associate knew the drill. The cruel part of the festivities was that the unlucky ones were simply not invited. They were left to retreat, to sneak out of the building and go wander the streets for the rest of the day. As Kyle ran up the stairs and raced along the hallways, he searched for his friends. There were high fives, yelps for joy, people running in shoes that were not meant for running. He saw Dale and gave her a hug, and they walked quickly together. Once on the mezzanine, the crowd was already in a raucous mood before Mr. Howard Meeser, the firm's managing partner, stepped to a small podium and said,
"Congratulations. Let's have a party. Not another hour can be billed today."
Champagne corks were soon flying. Bartenders were busy, and waiters began passing delicious antipasto. The general feeling was one of euphoria, even giddiness, because the nightmare was over, and they were now lawyers forever. Kyle was enjoying a glass of champagne with Dale and a few others when the conversation shifted to their less fortunate colleagues. "Does anybody see Garwood?" And they began searching the party for Garwood, who was unaccounted for and soon presumed to be on the other list. Tim Reynolds approached them with a nasty smile, a drink in one hand and a printout in the other.
"Tabor flunked," he announced proudly. "Can you believe it? A Harvard casualty."
Kyle wasn't as pleased. Sure, Tabor was obnoxious and opportunistic, but he was their cube mate, and flunking the bar would kill him. He wasn't a bad guy. Word spread. The body count rose. In all, there were 8 failures out of 103, a pass rate of 92%, an excellent number for any class at any firm. Once again, it was clear that they were the brightest stars and were now destined for even greater things. They got as drunk as possible, then rode home in private sedans arranged by the firm. Kyle had only 2 drinks and walked to Chelsea. Along the way, he called his father with the wonderful news. Chapter 24. His appointment at noon Friday with Doug Peckham was described as a working lunch to review some discovery, but when Kyle arrived 10 minutes early, the partner said, "Let's celebrate." They left the building and crawled into the back of a Lincoln sedan, one of the innumerable black cars that roam the city and keep the professionals out of the yellow cabs. The firm had a fleet of black cars on call. "Been to 11 Madison Park?" Doug asked. "No, I don't get out much these days, Doug, because I'm a first-year associate and I'm either usually too tired to eat or I don't have time, or I simply forget." "Whining, are we?" "Of course not." "Congrats on passing the bar."
"Thank you."
"You'll like this place. Great food, beautiful dining room. Let's have a long lunch with some wine. I know just the client we can stick it to." Kyle nodded. 2 months in, and he was still uncomfortable with the notion of sticking it to clients, padding the file, overbilling, racking up expenses. He wanted to ask what exactly the client was about to get stuck for. Just the lunch, which was a certainty, or would the client also get billed for 2 hours of his time and 2 hours of Peckham's? But he didn't ask. The restaurant was in the lobby of the old Metropolitan Life Building, with views of Madison Square Park. The decor was contemporary, with high ceilings and wide windows. Doug, of course, claimed to know the chef and the maitre d' and the sommelier, and Kyle was not surprised when they were seated at a choice table looking at the park. "Let's get your evaluation out of the way," Doug said, snapping a breadstick and sending crumbs across the pristine white tablecloth.
"Evaluation?"
"Yes, it's my job as your supervising partner to evaluate you after the bar results. Obviously, if you'd flunked, we wouldn't be here, and I wouldn't have nice things to say. We'd probably be stopping by one of those carts pushed by a street vendor, selecting a greasy kielbasa, taking a walk, and having a bad conversation. But you passed, so I'm going to be nice."
"Thank you."
The waiter presented menus while the water was poured. Doug chomped on a breadstick, more crumbs flying across the table. "Your billing is above average. In fact, it's very impressive."
"Thanks."
No surprise that any evaluation at Scully and Pershing would begin with how much money one was raking in. "I've had nothing but positive comments from other partners and senior associates."
"Drinks? Something to start with?" the waiter asked.
"We'll order some wine with lunch," Doug said, almost rudely, and the waiter disappeared. "At times, though, you seem to lack commitment, as if you're not fully on board. Fair?"
Kyle shook his head and thought about a response.
Doug was a no-nonsense type, so why not level with him?
"I live, eat, and sleep at the firm, like every other first-year associate, because that's the business model some guy came up with years ago, the same way medical residents go 20 hours a day to prove their mettle. Thank God we're not treating sick people. I don't know what else I can do to prove my commitment."
"Good point," Doug said, suddenly much more concerned with the menu.
The waiter hovered, waiting.
"You ready?" Doug said. "I'm starving."
Kyle had yet to look at the menu and was still stinging from the criticism of his commitment.
"Sure," he said. Everything looked delicious. They ordered, the waiter approved, and the sommelier appeared. At some point during the serious wine discussion that followed, Doug mentioned a first bottle and a second bottle. The first was a white burgundy.
"You'll love it," Doug said. "One of my favorites."
"I'm sure."
"Any problems? Complaints?" Doug asked, as if he were clicking off the items on the evaluation checklist.
With perfect timing, Kyle's firm phone vibrated.
"Funny you should mention it," he said as he pulled it from his coat pocket and looked at the email. "It's Carlene Sanborn, looking for a few hours of light lifting in the placid mortgage mess. What shall I tell her?"
"You're having lunch with me."
Kyle typed the email, sent it, then asked, "Can I turn this off?"
"Of course."
The wine was being presented. Doug sampled it and rolled his eyes, and two glasses were poured. Kyle pressed on. "My complaint is this damned phone. It has become my life. When you were an associate 15 years ago, they didn't have cell phones and smartphones and firm phones, and so..."
"We worked just as hard,"
Doug interrupted with a wave of dismissal. "Stop complaining. Get tough." With his other hand, he was raising his wine glass to inspect its contents. He finally took a sip, then nodded his approval. "Well, my complaint is this phone.
Okay. Anything else?
Another check mark in another box. No, just the usual complaints of associate abuse. You've heard them before, and you don't want to hear them now.
You're right, Kyle. I don't want to hear it. Look, as partners, we know what's going on. We're not oblivious. We survived it, and now we reap the rewards. It's a bad business model because everybody's miserable. You think I want to push myself out of bed at 5 every morning so I can spend 12 crazy hours at the office, so at the end of the year we can divide the spoils and be at the top of the rankings? Last year, Ape's partners averaged $1.4 million. We were at $1.3 million, and everybody panicked. We gotta cut costs. We gotta bill more. We gotta hire more associates and grind them into the concrete because we're the biggest. It's crazy. No one ever stops and says, hey, you know, I can live on $1 million a year and spend more time with my kids or more time at the beach. No, sir. We gotta be number one. I'll take $1 million a year. You'll get there. Evaluation's over.
One quick question.
Shoot.
There's a cute first-year associate, and I'm growing rather fond of her. How big a deal is it?
Strict prohibition. How cute?
Getting cuter by the day?
Name? Sorry. You gonna do it at the office?
Haven't got that far yet. There are plenty of sleeping bags.
Doug took a breath and leaned forward on his elbows.
There's a lot of sex around the place.
Come on, it's an office. You put 5,000 men and women together and it happens. The unwritten rule is this. Don't screw around with the employees. Secretaries, paralegals, support staff, clerks, those who are considered somewhat below us. We call them the non-lawyers. As for your fellow associates, or partners for that matter, no one really cares as long as you don't get caught.
I've heard some great stories.
They're probably true. Careers have been ruined. Last year, two partners, both married to other people, started a hot affair, got caught, and were kicked out. They're still looking for jobs. But for two unmarried associates, come on. Just don't get caught.
The first courses arrived, and sex was forgotten. Kyle had a leek and cheese tart. Doug went a bit heavier with a salad of Maine lobster with fennel and black trumpet mushrooms. Kyle drank less wine and more water. Doug was determined to polish off the first bottle and get to the second.
Bit of a shake-up is coming down, Doug said between bites. I'm sure you've heard.
Kyle nodded with a mouth full.
It's probably going to happen. 5 of our litigation partners are leaving with a bunch of associates and several clients. The mutiny is being led by Toby Rowland, and it's not pretty.
How many associates? Kyle asked.
26 as of this morning. It's a free-for-all. They're waving money and twisting arms, and no one knows how many will eventually leave, but it will knock a hole in litigation. We'll survive.
How do we fill the gap?
We'll probably raid another firm. They didn't teach you this in law school?
They both laughed and returned to their food for a moment. Will this increase the workload for those left behind? Kyle asked between bites.
Doug shrugged as if to say yes. Maybe. It's too early to tell. They're taking some big clients with some big lawsuits. In fact, that's why they're leaving.
Is Trilon leaving or staying?
Trilon is an old client, and it's firmly within the protective custody of Mr. Wilson Rush.
What do you know about Trilon?
Doug was eyeing him closely, as if they were moving into territory that was off limits.
Just what I've read in the newspapers and magazines. You ever worked for them?
Sure, several times.
Kyle decided to push on, just a little. A waiter removed their plates. Another poured more wine. What's this Barton dispute all about? The journal said the court file is locked away because the issues are so sensitive.
Military secrets? Huge sums of money involved. The Pentagon is all over it. They tried like hell to stop the companies from fighting, but it blew up anyway. There's a lot of technology involved, not to mention a few $100 billion.
Are you working on it?
No, I passed. It was quite a team, though.
Fresh bread arrived to cleanse the palate.
The first bottle was empty, and Doug ordered a second.
Kyle was carefully pacing himself. The partners and associates who are leaving, Kyle said. How many are working on the Barton lawsuit?
I don't know. Why are you so interested?
Because I don't want to work on it.
Why not? because I think Trilon is a rogue defense contractor with a rotten history of making cheap products, screwing the government and the taxpayers, dumping dirty weapons around the world, killing innocent people, promoting war, and propping up nasty little dictators, all in an effort to increase the bottom line and have something to show the shareholders.
Anything else?
Lots.
You don't like Trilon?
No.
The company is an extremely valuable client.
Good. Let someone else work for them.
Associates are not allowed to choose who they work for.
I know. I'm just sharing my opinion.
Well, keep it to yourself, okay? That kind of language will get you a lousy reputation.
Don't worry. I'll do the work that's assigned to me. But as a favor, as my supervising partner, I'm asking that you keep me busy elsewhere.
I'll see what I can do, but Mr. Rush makes the final decisions.
The second wine was a Pinot Noir from South Africa, and it too caused Doug's eyes to roll around. Their entrees, braised pork shoulder and aged prime rib of beef, were not far behind, and they got serious about eating.
You know your rate now goes to 400 an hour, Doug said, chewing.
Are you still at 800?
Yes.
Kyle was not sure he had the spine to bill a client, regardless of how large the corporation might be, $400 for an hour of his inexperienced legal work. Not that he had a choice.
On the subject of billing, Doug said, for the month of October, I need you to estimate my hours on the Ontario bank case. I got busy and lost track.
Kyle managed to keep chewing a small bite of braised pork, but he almost choked. Did he say, estimate my hours? He certainly did, and this was something new. There had been nothing at orientation, nothing in the handbook, nothing anywhere about estimating hours. Just the opposite. They had been trained to treat billing as the most important aspect of their practice. Pick up a file, look at the clock. Make a phone call, record the time. Sit through a meeting, count the minutes. Every hour had to be accounted for, and the billing was done on the spot. It was never to be delayed, and it had to be precise. How does one estimate hours? Kyle asked carefully.
Look at the file, check the hours you billed on it, look at my work, then estimate my time for the month of October. It's no big deal.
At $800 an hour, it was indeed a big deal.
And don't underestimate, Doug said, swirling his wine in the goblet.
Of course not. If we're going to guess here, let's be damn sure we land on the high side. Is this a common practice? Kyle asked. Doug snorted in disbelief and swallowed a hunk of beef. Don't be stupid, boy. It happens all the time.
And since we're now talking about Ontario Bank, he said, meat visible between his teeth, bill him for this lunch.
I was planning on getting the check, Kyle said, a lame effort at humor.
Of course not. I'll put it on a credit card and bill the bank. I'm talking about our time. 2 hours for you, now at 400, and two for me. The bank had record earnings last year.
That was nice to hear. They would need healthy earnings to continue their relationship with Scully and Pershing. $2,400 for lunch, and that did not include food, wine, or tip.
And now that you've passed the bar, Doug said as he took another bite, you are entitled to use the black cards and bill clients for dinner. The rule goes like this. If you work until 8 o'clock at night, then call a car. I'll give you the number and code and be sure the client gets billed for the car. And if you choose, you can go to a restaurant, spend no more than $100 on yourself, and also bill the client.
You gotta be kidding.
Why?
Because I'm at the office almost every night until 8. And if somebody else is buying dinner, then I'll be damned sure I stay until 8.
Attaboy.
Seems kind of rich, doesn't it?
What?
Billing the client for expensive dinners and lunches and cars?
A swirl of the Pinot, a thoughtful stare at the red liquid, a long pull.
Kyle, my boy, look at it this way. Our biggest client is BXL, the seventh largest company in the world. Sales last year of $200 billion. Very smart businessmen who have a budget for everything. They live by budgets. They are fanatics about budgets. Last year, their budget for legal fees was 1% of their total sales, or about $2 billion. We didn't get all of that, because they use 20 different law firms around the world, but we got our share. Guess what happens if they don't spend the amount they budget, if their legal fees fall short?
Their in-house lawyers monitor our billings, and if our numbers are low, they call up and raise hell. What are we, the lawyers, doing wrong? Aren't we properly protecting them? The point is, they expect to spend the money. If we don't take it, then it screws up their budgets. They get worried, and maybe they start looking around for another firm, one that will work harder at billing them. You follow? Yes, Kyle followed. It was beginning to make sense. Expensive meals were necessary not only to keep the hungry lawyers going, but also to properly balance their clients' financial statements. Now it seemed almost prudent. Yes, Kyle said, and for the first time the wine warmed his brain and made him relax. Doug spread his arms and looked around.
And look at where we are, Kyle. Wall Street. The absolute pinnacle of success in America. We're here. We're on top. We're smart and tough and talented, and we make a boatload of money to prove it.
We are entitled, Kyle. And don't forget it.
Our clients pay us because they need us, and we offer the best legal advice money can buy. Never forget that.
John McAvoy had lunch every day at the same table at an old cafe on Queen Street in York. And from the time Kyle was 10 years old and hanging around the office, he loved having lunch with his father. The cafe's special was a vegetable plate that varied each day and cost little, with homemade rolls and iced tea, no sugar. The cafe attracted lawyers, bankers, and judges, but there were also mechanics and bricklayers. The gossip roared, and the bantering was nonstop. The lawyers always joked, "Who's paying for lunch?" and boasted of wealthy clients who they'd stick with a $3.99 check. Kyle doubted that his father ever gave a passing thought to billing a client for lunch. Doug insisted on dessert. 2 hours after entering the restaurant, they pushed themselves out the door and into the black car. Both nodded off during the 15-minute ride back to the office. Chapter 25. For the first time in the 9-month life of the operation, Kyle contacted Benny and suggested they meet. All prior meetings had been prompted by the handler, not the asset. Kyle gave no reason for wanting to meet, but then none was necessary. It was assumed that Kyle finally had something valuable to pass along. It was almost 6 p.m. on Friday, and Kyle was working in the main library on the 39th floor. By email, Benny suggested the Hotel 60 Thompson in Soho, and Kyle agreed. Kyle always agreed because he was not allowed to disagree or suggest another meeting place. It didn't matter. He had no intention of showing up, not that Friday night. Joey wasn't in town yet. 4 hours later, Kyle was hiding in the Placid Mortgage tomb, mindlessly flipping through foreclosure files, now at $400 an hour, when he emailed Benny with the sad news that he wouldn't be leaving the office anytime soon. Could be an all-nighter. Although he loathed the work and hated the tomb and found it hard to believe he was still at the office so late on a Friday night, he was slightly amused at the image of Benny waiting impatiently in the hotel room for a meeting that would not take place because his asset was holed up in the office and wouldn't come out. The handler couldn't complain if the asset was hard at work. Kyle suggested a meeting late Saturday afternoon, and Benny took the bait. Within minutes, he emailed the instructions. 7 p.m., Saturday, room 42, Worcester Hotel in Soho. So far, a different hotel had been used for each meeting. On a desk phone, Kyle called Joey's new cell number and passed along the details. His flight from Pittsburgh would arrive at LaGuardia at 2:30 on Saturday afternoon. He would take a cab to the Mercer Hotel, check into his room, and kill time while his friend practiced law. He would roam the streets, walk in the front doors of bars and out the back, browse through bookstores, dart here and there in cabs, and when he was certain he was not being followed, he would drop in at the Worcester Hotel and mill around the lobby. He had in his pocket a copy of the Benny Wright composite Kyle had been perfecting for weeks. Joey had studied it for hours and was confident he could spot the man anywhere. Now Kyle wanted Benny in complete digital color. At 7:30, Kyle walked through the hotel lobby and took the elevator to the fourth floor. Benny had a small room, no suite this time. As Kyle tossed his trench coat and briefcase on the bed, he glanced into the bathroom.
"Just looking for Nigel, or perhaps another surprise,"
he said as he flipped on a light switch.
Just me this time, Benny said.
He was relaxing in a velvet chair.
You passed the bar. Congratulations.
Thanks. The inspection over, Kyle sat on the edge of the bed. The inspection had revealed no one but Benny, but it had also revealed no luggage, no shaving kit, nothing to indicate Benny would stay in the room after Kyle left.
You're putting in the hours, Benny said, again making an attempt at small talk. I'm a full-blown lawyer now, so evidently I'm expected to work even more.
He noted the shirt, light blue cotton, no pattern, no buttons on the collar, no necktie. The slacks were dark brown, wool, pleated. The jacket was evidently in the closet next to the bathroom, and Kyle cursed himself for not noticing it. Dark socks, no distinguishable color. Black scuffed shoes, quite ugly. Here's the scoop, Kyle said. 5 litigation partners are splitting off. Abraham, Devere, Hanrahan, Roland, and Bradley. They're opening up their own shop and stealing at least 3 clients in the process. As of last count, 26 associates are jumping with them. Of the partners, Bradley is the only one working on the Trilon Barton case. However, at least 7 of the associates are assigned to the lawsuit.
I'm sure you have a memo.
Kyle pulled out a single sheet of paper, tri-folded, and handed it over. It was a summary of the names of all the Scully and Pershing lawyers who were leaving. He knew Benny would want it in writing, something to preserve in the file and keep as evidence of his treachery. There. He'd finally done it. He'd handed over firm secrets, and now there was no turning back. Except that it was not exactly accurate. The gossip was changing by the hour, and no one seemed to know precisely who was planning to leave. Kyle had taken a few liberties with the names, especially those of the associates. Nor was it highly confidential information that he was passing along. The New York lawyer, the Trade Daily, had carried at least 2 brief stories about the spin-off in the litigation section of Scully and Pershing. Given the ever-shifting nature of law firm personnel, it was not headline news. And besides, Benny already knew as much as Kyle, and Kyle knew he knew. The memo gave no details about the business of any client. In fact, it did not mention a client by name. While it appeared to have been put together in a hurry, Kyle had spent time on it and was convinced it was not a violation of ethics. Benny unfolded the sheet of paper and studied it carefully. Kyle watched him for a moment, then said, "I need to use the bathroom."
"In there," Benny said, pointing without looking.
As Kyle walked to the bathroom, he passed the closet, its door half open, and hanging on a rack was a cheap navy sport coat and a dark gray trench coat.
"I'm not sure this means anything," Kyle said when he returned. "Trilon's in-house attorneys are hands-on, and they prefer the more experienced associates. Those who are leaving will likely be replaced with 3rd and 4th-year people. I'm still a long shot."
"Who'll take Bradley's place?"
"Not a clue. There are a lot of rumors."
"Have you met Sherry Abney?"
"Yes, we played softball together at the picnic in Central Park. We hit it off, but she's not in charge of which associates are assigned to the case. That decision rests with Mr. Wilson Rush."
"Patience, Kyle, patience.
Good intelligence is based on long-term placement and relationships. You'll get there."
"I'm sure I will, especially if you keep picking off the associates ahead of me."
"How'd you get rid of McDougal? Plant the drugs in his apartment?"
"Come on, Kyle. The young man had a serious problem with cocaine."
"He didn't need your help."
"He's on the road to recovery."
"You asshole, he's on the road to prison."
"He was dealing coke, Kyle.
A menace to society."
"What do you care about society?"
Kyle stood and began gathering his things.
"Gotta run. My old pal Joey Bernardo is in from Pittsburgh for the Jets game tomorrow."
"How nice," Benny said, getting to his feet.
He knew Joey's flight numbers, coming and going, and he knew their section and seat numbers for tomorrow's game.
"You remember Joey? The second one in your little video?"
"It's not my video, Kyle. I didn't take it. I just found it."
"But you couldn't leave it alone, could you?"
"Later."
Kyle slammed the door behind him and hurried down the hallway. He ran down 4 flights of stairs and entered the lobby not far from the elevators. He made eye contact with Joey, then went straight to the men's room around the corner. There were 3 urinals to the right. He straddled the center one, waited about 10 seconds,
then was joined by Joey on the left. There was no one else in the men's room. Light blue shirt, no tie, navy sport coat, all under a dark gray trench coat. Black-rimmed reading glasses that come and go, probably will not be wearing them when he comes down. No sign of a briefcase, hat, umbrella, or anything else. He should be alone. He is not staying for the night, so I expect him to be down shortly. Good luck. Kyle pulled the flush handle, left the room, and left the hotel. Joey waited 2 minutes, then returned to the lobby, where he picked up his newspaper from a chair and sat down. His dark hair had been cut short the day before and was almost entirely gray. He wore fake eyeglasses with thick black frames. The camera, slightly larger than a disposable pen, but practically indistinguishable from one, was in the pocket of his brown corduroy jacket, next to a red pocket square. A hotel security agent in a smart black suit watched him closely, though his curiosity had more to do with the relative inactivity of the lobby than with any real suspicion. 30 minutes earlier, Joey had explained to the agent that he was waiting on a friend who was upstairs. Two clerks behind the reception desk went about their business with their heads down, seeing nothing but missing little. 10 minutes passed, then 15. Each time an elevator door opened, Joey tensed slightly. He kept the newspaper low, on his knees, so that he could appear to be reading while the camera had a clear shot at the target. A bell. The door to the elevator on the left opened, and Benny the handler was there all by himself in a long gray trench coat. The composite of his face was remarkably accurate. Slick bald head, a few strands of black hair greased down about the ears, long narrow nose, square jaw, heavy eyebrows over dark eyes. Joey swallowed hard, his head down, and squeezed the on button in his left hand. For 8 steps, Benny walked directly toward him, then veered with the marble walkway toward the front door and was gone. Joey twisted his upper body slightly so the camera could follow. Then he switched it off, breathed deeply, and became engrossed in his newspaper. He looked up each time the elevator opened, and after 10 long minutes stood and walked back to the men's room. After lingering for half an hour, he feigned frustration with his tardy friend upstairs and stomped out of the hotel. No one followed. Joey plunged into the Saturday night chaos of Lower Manhattan, strolling aimlessly with the thick foot traffic, window shopping, ducking into music stores and coffee shops. He was convinced he'd lost his tail 2 hours earlier, but he took no chances. He hurried around corners and cut through narrow streets. At a used bookshop he'd scoped out late in the afternoon, he locked himself in the tiny toilet and washed his hair with a cleansing rinse that took out much of the gray. What was left was covered with a black Steeler's cap. He dropped the fake eyeglasses in the wastebasket. The video recorder was stuck deep in his right front pocket. Kyle waited nervously at the bar in the Gotham Bar and Grill on 12th Street. He sipped a glass of white wine and chatted occasionally with the bartender. Their reservation was for 9 p.m. The worst-case scenario, indeed the only way they could screw up the operation, was for Benny to recognize Joey and confront him in the lobby of the Worcester Hotel. It was a long shot, though. Benny knew Joey was in the city, but he would not recognize him in disguise, nor would he expect him to be anywhere near the hotel. Kyle was assuming that since it was Saturday night, and since he had done little, if anything, in 2 months to arouse suspicions, Benny would be traveling light with a skeleton crew on the streets. Joey arrived promptly at 9. His hair was almost natural. In fact, as he walked through the front door, Kyle could not see a hint of gray. He had somehow exchanged the well-used brown corduroy jacket for a more stylish black one. His smile told the story.
"Got him," he said as he took a stool and began looking for a drink.
"So?"
Kyle said softly as he watched the door for anything suspicious. "Double absolute on the rocks," Joey said to the bartender.
Then to Kyle, much lower, he said,
"I think I nailed him. He waited 16 minutes, used the elevator, and I shot him for at least 5 seconds before he passed by me."
"Did he look at you?"
"I don't know. I was reading the newspaper. No eye contact, remember? But he never slowed down."
"No trouble recognizing him?"
"No. Your composite is terrific."
They drank for a few moments as Kyle continued to watch the front door and as much of the sidewalk as he could see without being obvious. The maitre d' fetched them and led them to a table in the rear of the restaurant. After the menus were presented, Joey handed over the camera.
When can we see it? He asked.
A few days. I'll use a computer at the office.
Don't email me the video, Joey said.
Don't worry. I'll make a copy and send it snail mail.
Now what?
Good work, pal. Now we enjoy a fine meal, with wine, as you'll notice.
Proud of you.
And tomorrow we watch the Steelers kill the Jets.
They clinked glasses and savored their triumph.
Benny yelled at the three operatives who'd lost Joey after his arrival in the city. They had first lost him late in the afternoon, not long after he had checked in at the Mercer and hit the streets. They'd found him in the village before dark, then lost him again. Now he was having dinner with Kyle at the Gotham Bar and Grill, but that was exactly where he was supposed to be. The operative swore he moved as if he knew he was being followed. He had deliberately tried to shake them.
And did a damned fine job, didn't he? Benny yelled.
Two straight football games, one in Pittsburgh, now one in New York. More email chatter between the two. Joey was the only friend from college Kyle was now regularly in touch with. The warning signs were there. Something was being planned. Benny decided to beef up surveillance on Mr. Joey Bernardo. They were also watching Baxter Tate and his remarkable transformation.
Chapter 26.
At 4:30 on Monday morning, Kyle hurried off the elevator, alone, on the 33rd floor, and walked to his cube. As usual, lights were on, doors were open, coffee was brewed, someone was working. Someone was always working, regardless of the day or hour. The receptionists, secretaries, and clerks weren't due until 9 o'clock, but then they only worked a 40-hour week. The partners averaged around 70. It was not unusual for an associate occasionally to hit 100.
Good morning, Mr. McAvoy.
It was Alfredo, one of the plainclothes security agents who roamed the hallways during the weird hours.
Good morning, Alfredo, Kyle said as he wadded his overcoat and tossed it in a corner next to his sleeping bag.
How about those Jets?
Alfredo asked.
I'd rather not discuss it, Kyle shot back.
12 hours earlier, the Jets had drubbed the Steelers by 3 touchdowns in heavy rain.
Have a nice day,
Alfredo said happily as he walked away. His day obviously made better because his team had slaughtered the Steelers, and more important, he'd found a place to rub it in.
New York sports fans, Kyle mumbled as he unlocked his drawer and pulled out his laptop.
As he waited for it to power up, he glanced around to make sure he was alone. Dale refused to punch in before 6 o'clock. Tim Reynolds hated mornings and preferred to arrive around 8 o'clock and make up for it at midnight. Poor Tabor. The gunner had flunked the bar exam and had not been seen since. He'd called in sick last Friday, the day after the results were published, and evidently his sickness had continued throughout the weekend. But there was no time to worry about Tabor. He could take care of himself. Working quickly, Kyle slid the tiny T-clip from the video camera into an adapter, which he plugged into his laptop. He waited a few seconds, clicked twice, then froze as the image appeared. Benny in perfect color, standing at the elevator door, waiting patiently for it to open completely, then walking forward, the steady, confident walk of a man with no fears, no hurries, 4 steps over the marble floor, then a long glance down at Joey, but no connection, 5 more steps and he disappeared from view. Screen blank. Rewind. Watch it again and again, slower and slower. After the 4th step, when Benny looked casually at Joey, Kyle stopped the action and studied Benny's face. The shot was clear, the best of the video. He clicked on print and quickly made 5 copies. He had his man, at least on tape. How about this little video, Benny? Guess you're not the only one who can play games with hidden cameras. Kyle quickly fetched the copies from the printer beside Sandra's desk. All printing was supposed to be logged in and charged to a client, but no questions were asked by the secretary if a few pages were used for personal reasons. Kyle held the 5 copies and patted himself on the back. He stared at the face of his tormentor, his blackmailer, the rotten little son of a bitch who was currently in charge of his life. He thanked Joey for such a superb job. A master of disguise, too quick for the bloodhounds behind him, and a brilliant cameraman. There was a voice somewhere nearby, and Kyle put away his laptop, hid the T-clip,
and walked up 6 flights to the main library on the 39th floor. There, lost among the stacked tiers, he added 4 of the prints to his hidden file. The 5th he would mail to Joey with a note of congratulations. From an upper-level balcony, he looked down at the central floor of the library. Rows of tables and study carrels, piles of books scattered around urgent projects. He counted 8 associates hard at work, lost in a world of research for memos and briefs and motions that were past due. 5 o'clock on a Monday morning in early November. What a way to start the week. The next step in his scheme had not yet been determined. He wasn't certain there was a next step, but for the moment, Kyle was content to take a breath, savor a small victory, and tell himself there was a way out. Just minutes after the markets opened Monday, Joey was chatting with a client who wanted to dump some more oil stocks when his second desk phone rang. He routinely carried on more than one phone conversation at the same time, but when the second caller said, "Hey, Joey, it's Baxter. How are you?" Joey got rid of the client.
"Where are you?" Joey asked.
Baxter had left Pittsburgh 3 years earlier, after they graduated from Duquesne, and he seldom returned. When he did, though, he rounded up the old gang, those who could not avoid him, and threw some wild, drunken party that killed a weekend. The longer he stayed in L.A. and pursued his acting career, the more insufferable he became when he was back home.
"Here, in Pittsburgh," he said. "Clean and sober for 160 days now." "That's great, Baxter. Wonderful. I knew you were in rehab." "Yes, Uncle Wally again. God bless him. You got time for a quick lunch? I need to talk to you about something."
They had never had lunch, not since college. Lunch was too civilized for Baxter. When he met friends, it was always at a bar with a long night ahead of them.
"Sure, what's up?" "Nothing much. Just want to say hello. Grab a sandwich and meet me down at Point State Park. I'd like to sit outdoors and watch the boats." "Sure, Baxter."
Since it was all so obviously planned, Joey was becoming suspicious.
"Noon okay?" "See you then."
At noon, Baxter showed up with nothing to eat, nothing but a bottle of water. He was thinner and dressed in old dungarees, a faded navy sweater, and a pair of black combat boots, all selected from the second-hand shop above Brother Manny's shelter for the homeless. Long gone were the designer jeans, Armani jackets, and crocodile loafers. The old Baxter was history.